I'm Afshan Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of a Middle East dominated by what some are calling a genocide of Christians as well as Shia and Sunni Muslims in western Syria after years of British and EU support for al-Qaeda there. While the Trump administration has so far limited its rage to social media, the US president now relies on Lieutenant Colonel Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence, who has long opposed NATO nation support for Jalani, the al-Qaeda al-Nusra leader now leading Syria. Any policy change will come too slow to save the lives of thousands of men, women and children massacred in the past week. Will US policy on the proxy war in Ukraine change more quickly? While Western European leaders today scheme to continue the war under the haunted phrase, the coalition of the willing, redolent of the catastrophic invasion of Iraq, top Trump officials have been meeting in Moscow after this week's bizarre ceasefire offer in Saudi Arabia. After initial optimism, Moscow officials question whether US top diplomat Marco Rubio is on the same page about ending a conflict sparked by a coup in Kiev under Barack Obama. Someone who advised Obama's administration is Professor Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former director of European Affairs at the U.S. National Security Council, joins me again from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Professor Kupchan, for coming back on. I do want to get on to Ukraine, but it's 14 years since what Assad himself on this program described as the beginning of genuine expressions of dissatisfaction with his government erupted in Damascus, the demonstrations that were then brutally put down. You warned in Project Syndicate against optimism when the al-Qaeda leader, al-Nusra leader Jalani took power just a few months ago. Your reaction first to what's going on, even here in Dubai, roads full of corpses, Syria's terrified Alawites flee attacks. The pictures are all over social media of what's going on, even if they're not on corporate mainstream media. This is from the Dubai Gulf News.
Well, you know, what's transpired in the last few days is tragic. We're seeing a significant loss of life. We're seeing not just the killing of Alawis, but Druze are starting to flee, fearful that they may be next in line. I have to say, I'm not surprised by the recent bloodletting. In some ways, I expected this to happen earlier, given the deep-seated sectarian, religious, ethnic divisions within the country. It remains to be seen whether the aspirations of this new government to build something that constitutes a diverse, inclusive governing system, it remains to be seen whether this happens. I have to say, I remain skeptical. The one thing that I think is positive is that the new government hasn't sort of dismantled the system in the same way that the United States did after the invasion of Iraq, where they basically took down the entire government and left Iraq standing in the rubble.
So you're hopeful the government institutions are going to help it, because the Trump administration is very aware of how where you are at, the Council on Foreign Relations, the role your organization played in continually putting think tank shows, debates on social media at different events, supporting al-Qaeda. That's what the Council on Foreign Relations did, isn't it? And Tulsi Gabbard is the Director of National Intelligence, the role of the United States in supporting al-Qaeda. We know they support...
You know, you agree that the United States...
I've got the memo here from Jake. I've got the famous memo, the email to Clinton, Hillary Clinton. I know you weren't. I've got the email. Jake Sullivan, al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria, right? Otherwise, things are basically turned out as expected.
Broadly speaking, the United States supported what was called the Syrian Democratic Forces, the FDF, that was primarily staffed by Syria's Kurds. And it included some elements of various Arab opposition groups. But I think it would be erroneous to say that the United States in some ways backed al-Qaeda. This was an effort to support
this is the National Security Advisor.
The Assad regime.
Sorry, this is the former National Security Advisor to Joe Biden writing to Hillary Clinton, saying it so. But clearly, Tulsi Gabbard, his director of national intelligence, said Assad is not the enemy of the United States. She's across all of the facts surrounding suspicious fake chemical attacks. You just look at what Tulsi Gabbard has said over the years against the Council on Foreign Relations' views about Syria. I mean, what does it make you feel? You weren't really aware that they were supporting al-Qaeda? Because I know you were there 2014 to 2017. This email was 2012, it was exposed by WikiLeaks. February the 12th, 2012, the email showing the United States is on the side of al-Qaeda.
Again, I think you're distorting what happened. The Islamic State
took
advantage of the chaos in the country. The United States worked with various parties to try to take down the Islamic State. I'm someone who was skeptical of the interventions in the region, whether it is Syria, whether it is Iraq, whether it is Afghanistan. But the one thing that I do support was the effort to dismantle the caliphate that the Islamic State built in Syria and Iraq. And I think that was a service to the region as well as to others that were in the target.
Hang on, Professor. Jilani was in that, right? Jilani was ISIS's man. He was al-Nusra's man. He's the guy being financed by Britain today. Just the other day, Britain announced £50 million, I don't sure what in dollars that is, sent over to him. The United States hasn't. The Trump administration is not supporting this ISIS al-Qaeda leader, Jilani. As you said, just ahead of his inauguration, his coronation, you're basically just saying the chaos is deeply disturbing and we should expect worse.
Well, Jilani is at least claiming to have changed his tune and aspires, at least according to his own rhetoric, to build an inclusive government. We'll have to see how it goes. But so far, countries are beginning to get behind him, not so much because they trust him, but because he happens to represent the existing government of Syria. And there's an effort to work with the government that you have, not the government that you might want.
Some might say they would have hoped that would have happened under President Assad. Who knows? 2014, let's get to Ukraine. 2014, also the year, of course, of the Victoria Nuland coup in Ukraine. Your analysis recently of what the Secretary of State Rubio admits is a proxy war, you might have to tell us about your recent analysis and whether you've gone over to the other side. You're a Moscow Putin puppet, because certainly the kind of things you're saying in Western Europe would be considered to be Russian talking points.
Well, number one, I reject the idea that this was somehow a U.S. planned coup. This was a grassroots revolution, the Maidan revolution, that occurred after the president of Ukraine decided to steer Ukraine away from integration into Europe and toward deeper integration into a Russian sphere of influence. And many Ukrainians said, been there, done that, no thank you. The Russians called it a coup. It was not. You know, I'm someone who has believed for several years now that this is a war that needs to end at the negotiating table and that Ukraine is not in a position to win or to take back eastern Ukraine from Russian forces. And as a consequence, I welcome Trump's effort to bring the war to an end. I welcome Trump's effort to build a constructive dialogue with Mr. Putin and the Russian government. I don't like the way this has been done. It's a mess. But it looks like, at least for now, we have a serious offer by the Ukrainians to begin a 30-day ceasefire. Let's see how the Russians respond.
I don't want to go over ancient history in a way, but you still don't accept it was a coup. You have listened to the phone call from Victoria Nuland to the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. You've listened to the phone call, right? It is a coup. We know we have the phone call where she's picking who's going to run Ukraine.
You know, I would not cherry pick this phone call or that memo.
You've listened.
And say, aha, we have evidence that the U.S. supports al-Qaeda. We have evidence that Ukraine toppled because of an American coup. The U.S., Victoria Nuland may have had views about who should be the governor, the president, the whatever of Ukraine, but that fundamentally, Avshin, is not what happened. This was a grassroots revolution. It was met with firing squads by the existing government. He had to pick up and flee the country because the people of Ukraine had had enough of him. That's basically why we are now in a situation the Russians wouldn't let go.
Okay, I'm not sure the people of
Ukraine leaving the Russian orbit, and as a consequence, they grabbed Crimea and went into eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, the people of Crimea, Donetsk, Luhansk, I'm not sure. They were also once part of Ukraine. I don't think they would share that opinion. But anyway, back to the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who gets to see all the intelligence. She said Biden wanted to destroy Russia. Biden wanted to destroy Russia at risk of nuclear war, not to support Zelensky. The EU, US, and NATO fuel this war. This is about regime change in Russia to strengthen NATO and feed the military-industrial complex. That is the Director of National Intelligence, but you are denying even what Rubio said. You're saying it's not a proxy war, he said in February 2020.
Actually, with all due respect, you are on the wrong side of history, right? Russia has launched an imperial war of conquest. Russian is pounding Russian, Ukrainian civilians.
So it's not me who's saying that. It's Tulsi Gabbard.
I have to say, I don't understand why you are defending a Russian war of aggression against its neighbor.
Sorry,
what's the point?
Professor, it's not me who's saying those. It's Lieutenant Colonel Tulsi Gabbard, the director of U.S. National Intelligence, who said that. I'm not saying that.
Well, I disagree with a lot of the things that are said by the Trump officials. So take it with a grain of salt.
So you don't agree with Marco Rubio that it's a proxy war?
It has turned into a proxy war of sorts, but it's fundamentally about Putin's belief that Ukraine doesn't deserve to exist as an independent state and his desire to pull 40 million Ukrainians back into Russian sphere of influence. And guess what? It's not going to work. Putin has lost Ukraine by alienating millions and millions of Ukrainians who for the rest of history are not going to want anything to do with Mother Russia.
Yeah, the president of Russia has never made any claims on Western Ukraine, as far as I know. But I mean, so you don't agree with the director of national intelligence. You said it's a sort of proxy war. I mean, either it's a proxy war or it isn't. I mean,
no, it is turned into a proxy war because the Russians have attempted to swallow Ukraine. Joe Biden led the effort to prevent that from happening, and it was successful. Ukraine is still standing. Now the goal, which I think Trump is pursuing, is to make sure that the 80% of Ukraine that is still free emerges as a secure, defensible, prosperous success story. We'll see how that effort goes.
Professor Kupchan, I'll stop you there. More from the senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former director for European Affairs on the U.S. National Security Council under Presidents Obama and Clinton, Professor Charles Kupchan. Professor Kupchan, you were saying how you think the Trump administration may understand a way of ending it. I mean, you also said the West does not want to fight with Russia, has gone out of its way to prevent this war from widening. Would you still stand by that?
Yes. I mean, I think that both sides, the Russians as well as NATO members, have from the beginning been careful not to see this war in Ukraine turn into World War III. And some criticize Biden for moving too slowly on tanks, on HIMARS, on long-range systems. And I think that Biden was smart to be careful. And so far, this war has not expanded. It has not turned into a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia. If it were to do so, it would be extraordinarily dangerous, which is yet another reason that I've been arguing against the grain that this war needs to end at the negotiating table. And as I said, I welcome Trump's effort to do just that.
So why Why is it you're so alone in arguing such a, you know, it's hardly extreme position to support diplomacy after so many hundreds of thousands have been killed, so many in Western Europe have been impoverished by the sanctions? You're not even saying, you're still supporting the sending of US public money for weaponry to fight this proxy war, and yet your opinion is so rare in Washington circles?
Well, you know, the view that I've articulated has become more mainstream over time,
in part since
because
Trump.
It's apparent that, you know, Russia has the upper hand on the battlefield. But I think the reluctance to go down this route is in part about not wanting to accept a outcome in which Russia succeeds in chewing off a chunk of Ukrainian territory by force. Is it a setback for a system that defends sovereignty and territorial integrity? Yes, but ultimately you've got to let pragmatism take precedence over principle and stop a war that is leading to untold death and destruction, which is why in the end, I believe that it is time to end this war, even if it means that 20% of Ukraine is under Russian occupation.
You see, that's not the kind of intel that's been provided to President Trump, clearly, based on what Tulsi Gabbard has been saying in the past few years. They're not chewing off bits of Ukraine. Those parts of Luhansk and Donetsk had already declared themselves independent republics. Crimea overwhelmingly wants to be part of Russia. Convenient for Russia, of course, because it has that base there. They're not chewing off bits of Ukraine. They're taking back parts of Ukraine that have been ruthlessly bombed since 2014 and the coup, and where the Russian language, the Russian church, where Russian schools, you've seen the neo-Nazi symbols on the fighting in the East.
You know, maybe you are getting your copy from the Kremlin.
No, from your director of national intelligence.
That is just a bunch of BS, right? Are there ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in Eastern Ukraine? Yes. Is the Jewish president of Ukraine a neo-Nazi? Come on, Ashton, let's talk in a serious way here. Were the Ukrainians killing ethnic Russians in Eastern Ukraine? No, this is a war of aggression. This is what Putin does. He grabs chunks of Georgia. He grabs chunks of Moldova. He grabs chunks of Ukraine. This is his political brand, what he's done in Ukraine.
I just got to respond to the Jewish point. I mean, Obama, who you worked for, was black. I think there was still racism in your country. I don't think the fact that Zelensky is Jewish can mean that all those Nazi insignia that we saw on the front lines in the East, we have to, like, disbelieve our own eyes. We know. I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson advises some of the administration officials. He's done programs about the Nazis in there.
Come on. This is not a serious argument. Were there and are there far-right militias in Ukraine? Yes, there are far-right militias almost everywhere. Is the Ukrainian government run by neo-Nazis? Hey, come on, stop.
I didn't say
Russian Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I didn't say it was necessarily run by them, but we know the kind of prejudice. I'm just saying the chewing off of bits of Ukraine isn't quite right, some might say.
And no, that's exactly what happened. It's a land grab.
The peoples of those areas want to be part of Russia, is what I think any independent expert from, say, a BRICS country might say. You said Russia had been weakened, Russia's military had been weakened. I mean, your position may not be the same as John Bolton, who comes on this show quite a bit, but it is similar to these talking points that kind of informed the Biden administration's views. So how is it to react to the new Trump administration world, where actually, no, Russia has been strengthened, Russia's military is strengthened, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has been strengthened, BRICS has been strengthened. This has been one of the greatest successes of Russian power and alliances or links to the global South and, of course, China in history?
You know, I just see it differently. I think that when the dust settles, this war will be seen as a major strategic defeat for Russia? Is it the case that China, Iran, and North Korea are on Russian side? Yeah, but that's not a very impressive coalition. You're right that many developing countries have not said, we're with you, Russia. They don't want to put their head in the middle of this struggle. But basically, I think most people around the world see this act of Russian aggression for exactly what it is. That having been said, as I welcome what Trump is doing. I think the Biden people were too ideological. I wish that Biden had attempted to end this war 1 or 2 years ago. It's overdue. It's past time for the United States to use its diplomatic muscle to end this war. But let's be honest about this. This is a Russian act of aggression, and it will go down in history as such.
Why is it Russia, China, Iran, North Korea? You don't think that's a big deal? I mean, Russia, as you say, has been hurt by all of this, weakened. It just overtook Japan by GDP, by PPP, according to the IMF. I'm speaking to you from a country, the UAE, which is monitoring and an observer status for the drills this week, naval drills conducted by Russia, China, and Iran. And, of course, we've seen a new world here in the global south emerge. And you're saying somehow Russia has been weakened. What is this mismatch? And do you think Trump sees it differently, which is why he was so quick to say, hey, any country that abandons the dollar like a BRICS country will immediately tariff to 100%.
You know, is the world changing? Yes. Is the global distribution of power shifting from west to east and north to south? Yes. Do developing countries from India to Brazil to the Saudis to the Emiratis to the Qataris, do they feel opportunity and have agency? Yes, in part because they're playing the field. One day they're cozying up to Washington, the next day to Moscow. But I don't think that Russia's dependence on North Korean troops, on Iranian drones, is an example of great Russian power. It's an example of Russian weakness. And I think everything else being equal, the Chinese would like to see this war come to an end sooner rather than later. So as I said, when the dust settles, I think that Russia will find itself paying for this war for generations to come. It was a huge strategic mistake. And when historians ask the question, who lost Ukraine, the answer will be clear, Vladimir Putin.
Which lost Ukraine? I mean, obviously Trump wants closer ties between Washington and Moscow. It's not in the interest of the United States to have a weakened Russia whatsoever. A weakened Russia, a less secure Russia would mean perhaps the greater the threat to all your cities there in the United States. I mean, you mentioned the weakness of North Korea. You know North Korea could destroy Los Angeles, in a matter of half an hour? You don't have the actual defensive capability to stop a North Korean missile, so the intelligence suggests. What is it going to be like in the Washington Beltway and think tanks then as regards understanding the new world that you're recognizing? Because everything that they said, whether it was their support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, their support for Al-Qaeda in Syria, whether it be their support for Zelensky and their self-sanctioning and the destruction of the European economies, they're going to have to understand the new world, aren't they? Because Beijing, Moscow and Washington are arguably on the same page about the new world and how tariff-free, free trade, mixture of that, and multipolarity are really what is required now, not neo, what was it called? Neocon? Some kind of philosophy from the project for the 21st century, 20th century?
Well, Afshin, I think that the questions that you're asking are the big questions of our time. Unfortunately, they're not really being debated, in part because the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Chinese support for Russia, the American-led effort to counter and rebuff Russia. This has polarized the international system, and it is, in many respects, prevented the debate about how to manage this transition to multipolarity that I think you and I agree is the debate we need to have. I don't think that it will happen under the Trump presidency. Yes, he breaks the mold. Yes, he's said enough of this so-called liberal rules-based order. It doesn't work abroad. It doesn't work at home. But since I live here in Washington, I can tell you that right now, everything is just a big churn, a big swirl. 1 minute, more tariffs. The next minute, take back. 1 minute, we're annexing Canada. The next minute, we're talking about taking control of the Panama Canal. This kind of churn and chaos in Washington is going, I think, to be, unfortunately, the rule for the next 4 years, rather than the kind of forward-looking debate that we need to have.
Some enjoy it, you know, especially if it's going to have peace after the hundreds of thousands that are being killed under the Biden administration. Just finally, just got time to ask you. I mean, here's the Japanese FT, Financial Times. Europe forced to examine future in which US switches off its weapons. I've just got to quickly ask, given that there's a virtual conference in Europe about this new superpower of the Western European rump of Eurasia, what's going to happen to Europe?
Well, you know, I get why Europeans have pushed the panic button. And that's because they are contemplating a future in which their American partner drifts off into the sunset, removes its troops, pulls out of NATO. I actually don't think that's going to happen, because I don't see what's in it for Trump to dismantle the West and to pull out of NATO. But Europeans have no choice to ask that question, because the U.S. is now living through a period of political dysfunction, of political inconstancy, that is going to force our allies to say, can we count on Uncle Sam? Is Europe over time going to acquire more geopolitical heft and military capability? Yeah, but it's going to take a very long time. And that's one of the reasons that I think in the end of the day, the Europeans will do their best to keep American troops and to keep Donald Trump anchored on the other side of the Atlantic.
Professor Charles Kupchan, thank you.
Good to be with you.
That's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday with one of the 20th century's greatest economic historians, Lord Skidelsky of the UK House of Lords, who claims a muddled, shambolic Britain risks global irrelevance for supporting Zelensky. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.